Guys, welcome to The Pulse. We've got an exciting, fun program for you today. We always talk to people who are doing cool things. They're making a difference. They're using their voice and their talents, and they're entertaining us. And Tan France, Queer Eye Fab Five, you do all that kind of stuff. That's just one of the titles we can throw out there for you.
I would like to believe I do all that stuff. I don't know. I try.
Okay. Well, but so I'm speaking it into existence.
Yes.
You do all of those things.
I do all of those things and many more. Right. Many more.
There you go. Yeah. That's how we start with it. I'm going to ask for a pass on your fashion sense today because this is the third interview that I've done today. And I'm going to give you a little
To be fair, it's really hard to see what you got on.
Okay, good.
You're far away from me.
Okay. Well, that was by design. And part of that is because it's the third interview I've done today. And so we have to keep coming up with different ways to coordinate more or less the same outfit.
Oh.
So it doesn't look like.
And also, you and I both have this issue. Typically, I don't in my regular job. You've only got that to work with.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, if all you've got is a shirt, it makes it a little bit harder to cope with exciting things.
Yes. That is true. And my day job is working in news, so I have to be able to go upstairs, grab a jacket that I could also put on if there's a breaking news situation.
Yes.
So
yes.
All that. Yes. All right. So enough about me.
No. So just to be clear, no judgment about what you've got on today.
Okay. Fair enough. And your hair looks good. You're
Thank
coordinate.
You.
Like your the outfit is solid.
Thanks.
So I'm going ahead. That's my.
If it wasn't, I would be very concerned because it's the bulk of my job.
and I don't know how much my compliments about fashion actually mean, but
I'll take it.
I will go ahead and share them. Getting started in the discussion, give us a little bit of a background on you, kind of the journey to getting into fashion. I know it's a lot, but kind of the journey to get here.
Yeah. Well, I was born and raised in the UK. I come from a small town. And my grandfather used to live in a town about an hour away. And my parents would send us to his house and my grandma and grandpa's house for the holidays. And every holiday, I would want to go to work with my grandpa because he owned a factory and he used to make denim clothing. And so I learned how to make clothing very, very young. And then I signed up for fashion college when I was in my late teens, loved that. And then I moved to America and I thought, well, I want to start my own business. And so I did. And as far as I'm concerned, America is still the land of the land of opportunity. And the American dream is still very much real, especially for me. And so I came here, I started businesses. I had four where I made, designed and created women's clothing that I would sell to the mass audience. And things went very, very well. And then I retired. And a few days later, Netflix got in touch and asked if I would be interested in being on Queer Eye. And I said yes. And the rest is history.
So the fashion part you kind of got into at a young age. So you knew you wanted to do that. And that was always kind of the journey?
Always. I went to college also for psychology because my parents wanted me to have a real job. Partway through that, I realized this is never going to be my life. I have no interest in this. Fashion was always going to be it for me. But I thought that that would be my entire life. I thought that I would have these clothing businesses forever. There was no real plan to retire that early. I wanted to retire early, but not that early.
The plan was to retire early because you know that you just kind of like you've gotten so comfortable saying this that you just kind of skated past the fact that, yeah, I did these jobs. I had four different companies. I retired and then went on to Queer Eye. And you just kind of skated past the fact that this was in your early 30s.
Yeah, I was 32. And I know that sounds really silly, but my businesses did well. I don't know what to tell you. My businesses did well. And I was like, well, we don't really need to work. And I wanted to have children. And so I thought, well, let's give up the businesses. Let me have children. And I want to raise my children across the world. I want them to travel lots with me. And that will be a big part of their education. And I never expected to have anything other than fashion as my job. And yes, I know that on Queer Eye, I work with clothes. And that is a an important part of my job. But that's not really my job. My job is human connection and hopefully helping people change their lives and be a positive force in their lives, as opposed to this is the hottest trend, let's get you in, right. I don't know, whatever, insert any designer's name. So yeah, this was never meant to be my plan. I was about to say I got lucky. I did not get lucky. The Netflix stuff was lucky, but that wouldn't have come to me unless I'd seen great success elsewhere first.
Yeah, right. Well, true. And even the Netflix stuff, as you said, is not lucky. It was a result of the success that you've had in other places.
Yeah.
And they're like,
and the show was no, and the success of Queer Eye, there was no guarantee. We worked really hard to create a show that was very different from any other show. And we had conversations as a cast as to what we wanted to do on that show. And it was to put something really positive out there in the world. And in 2018, that wasn't reality television. Reality television was throw a glass of wine, flip the table, yes, and that's how you make television.
So then you had to stick to that. They reach out to you and say, we want you to do Queer Eye. I mean, obviously you're familiar with the concept because of...
Roughly, I'd never seen the show.
Really?
So the American version wasn't available in the UK, I believe, or we just didn't have cable. So I never saw it. There was a British version, and I'd seen an episode of the British version, but the British version didn't do very well. They had one season, then it was over. So I didn't really know the show. I hadn't seen that episode since I was like, what, 17, 16? So it had been a heck of a long time.
So the OGs, like I've had the pleasure of interviewing Carson Kressley. He was here.
Yeah.
We kind of went through that. Yeah. So those types of folks early on really didn't have that much of an impact on you.
No, not at all. To be fair, until we were about to do a thing with the original Fab Five, I didn't know Carson. I didn't know the original cast names when I got the job. I really had no idea who they were. But we got to know them when we were doing the first press junket for Queer Eye, and they were so lovely, like so, so lovely. And they had a massive success with Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. But I chose not to watch the original show, the Queer Eye for the Straight Guy show, because I didn't want to become a caricature of Carson. I didn't want to know what they did. I was just told what the job was, and I told what the expectation was, and I was like, I'm going to do it my way. And I think that that's why I really struggled the first few weeks. This is very well documented, but I tried to quit many times within the first 3 weeks because I thought, I can't possibly do this job where all I'm doing is being myself. They must want me to play a part, and I can't play a part, so I must quit the show. And then finally they were like, no, we kind of love that you didn't know how to do this. You're saying exactly what you want to say. You're the most real version of what we hoped for a show like this.
So if you didn't know the kind of what the show was, or it's almost like you had to go through, or tell me, is it like you had to go through some of the same things that they had to go through? You're being very visible. Dealing with all of those different challenges, and you didn't know what you were walking into. So why'd you even want to do it?
Well, for a couple of reasons. I think people would believe it was for the money and the fame. I had money, I was doing great.
You were already retired at 33.
Yeah, I was doing just fine. The fame of it all, don't get me wrong, it's enticing, but that is not the thing. After a couple of weeks, believe me, it's nowhere near as appealing as one might believe. It was more, this is going to sound so, but I'm just going to say it. My husband made it very clear that I had gone on and on and on for a long time about there being no one like me on television. Mm-hmm. There weren't any queer Muslims out there. There were no queer South Asians on television. There were so few South Asians. There were probably three in entertainment. Mm. And I was being given this job. I auditioned, but I was given this job, and it was made very clear that they were going to do all they could to make this a massive show. This was Netflix's first unscripted show ever. And Netflix was really becoming the thing at that point. And so I thought, I actually might be one of the first big South Asians globally. And this was the first global show, I want you to remember. And so I could be a global representative of what it is to be a South Asian. That feels great.
Huh. Yeah, it's interesting because it is, and this whole show, that doesn't sound corny to me, because the whole premise of this show is the phrase, use your voice for good. So the concept of being able to try to do bigger things,
yeah,
is cool. It's also a little scary, isn't it? I mean, you're sitting there saying I could be all of these things. That also means you have to shoulder the responsibility of being all of these things.
Yeah. I've spoken about this for so long now, making it very clear to everyone listening. Yes, it sounds exciting thinking, gosh, I could be the first. And that was enticing. But it was also the reason why I was so scared. And I also wanted to quit because of this reason, saying, I don't think I really thought this through. I will be the punching bag for everybody that hasn't seen somebody like me before or who identifies the same way I do. And we all know a marginalized group wants the perfect version to represent them. I'm not the perfect brown person. I'm not the perfect Muslim. I'm not the perfect queer person. I'm not the perfect anything. And so after the show came out, I learned very quickly that many people felt that way. And it has been the main reason why I say fame isn't all that it cracked up to be, is because of that. I think that so many want to feel represented, but they don't want to feel represented. They want to be represented by themselves only, not as someone close to them, not someone close enough to them. They want them. Why wasn't it them? Why can't it be my perfect version? And I can't possibly be your perfect version of any of those things.
So you with all of that, you started experiencing that. You said that you kind of wanted to quit after starting doing that. But I would imagine the positivity, the energy, you stayed with it. So the critical is much less than the positive that you get from doing this?
Yeah, because it was outweighed by an outpouring of absolute love and shock from so many who are like me, who I would receive messages from people in obscure places, but also places that I'm from, Pakistan, saying, I can't believe that you are able to be so open and free and live so freely a life that I could only dream of. And that gives me hope. And it took me right back to who I was as a kid, thinking, gosh, if there was somebody that was even remotely like me, I might believe that there is a chance of survival here, that there's a chance of living a full life. And as a young queer Pakistani Muslim, you don't think that too often. You don't think, oh, I can succeed and I'm going to thrive as an adult. You don't. You think there's probably a possibility that life won't go so well and I may not live past a certain age. And so to be able to speak to that audience and say, no, there's always hope. That's really important.
When you say that out loud, I just listened to you say it and I kind of went, wow. When you look at all of the things, you just said young, queer, Pakistani, Muslim. Mm-hmm. You didn't say on a globally, watched show.
Yeah.
That just doesn't happen.
No. The funny thing is, I knew I was a token when I first took this job, and I was like, okay, that's fine. It always starts with a token. You have to. But eventually, within the next couple of years, there'll be many more to follow, at least more South Asians. There really aren't. So 7.5 years on, it is sad to see that we haven't progressed too much.
Yeah, but you're kicking down those doors and you're happy to kick down those doors. I mean, that now you've got those years behind you. You know what that feels like. You're OK with that role.
I mean, I'm not saying I'm OK with it. Look, I haven't developed a thick enough skin where nothing hurts me. I still get very hurt by certain things that I read about me or are said about me. But mostly, this is going to sound incredibly arrogant, but I'm going to say this anyway. Financial independence means that you can say a lot of things that people can't say if they're desperate for a paycheck. Mm-hmm. And coming into this business financially independent meant that I would say yes to the jobs I want to say yes to. I will say no to anyone I want to say no to. And I know that a lot of people think that I'm a very forthright, aggressive person. And that's fine. I balance it out by being exceptionally kind to everybody. But I remind everybody, I'm no fool. I made my success and myself. And I don't need anybody to rescue me or save me. And your money can't do me any favors.
Yeah, the money part's interesting, though, because we see more and more. And you talk about when you have the money, you don't necessarily need to work for a paycheck. But I think, unfortunately, we see more and more even people that you would think have their financial independence get caught up in quotes, playing the game. They do it for the check, or they cave like you should have what some wealthy people I'm familiar with call, you know, FU money. You know, if you're in that position, but you still don't have independence, then kind of what's the point of having it?
Yeah. I mean, look, that then doesn't come down to them needing it financially. They're looking for something that I'm not looking for. I'm not looking for power. I'm just looking for happiness for myself and my family. I'm not necessarily desperate to change the world the way that, and I've got a feeling we're both talking about the same thing. We've seen it this week. I'm not looking for that kind of power. I'm looking for power in my own household, which is I get to be at home with my kids more than most. I get to provide for my children and not have to worry about that and send them to the kind of schools I want to send them to. So yes, there are people who are shockingly wealthy who are still out there doing things that I don't agree with, but they're looking for something other than financial independence.
I feel like this, what you're talking about, I was talking to people, I always do, when we're about to interview people, I talk to folks around. Our producer who booked this, her comment was, this show isn't about fashion, it's about humanizing people, and I end up crying through multiple episodes. One of our other folks upstairs, as I was telling her I was getting ready to come down and talk to you, she was like, I love them and I love that show because they're about empowering people and humanizing people. And is that what you were going for? Because fashion is there, but it's not really what the show is about.
It's so not what the show is about. So for anyone who hasn't seen it, there's five categories. Food, fashion, grooming, which we call beauty, interior design, and culture. And I fulfill the fashion component, which is I do the physical makeover, which is you start in one look. By the end of the episode, you've got a full new wardrobe. But it's just a vehicle to have a conversation. And I would like to believe I'm the most privileged on the show with my vertical, because there's something about stripping somebody down to their most vulnerable parts, which is, I don't see them in their underwear, but they are in their underwear. And then I put them in something that is quite jarring to them. And when you do that, they open up and they confide in you in a way that they typically would never do so if you would just ask them the question. But when I'm in a fitting room with them and I want them to look at their body in the mirror and tell me the things that they like and they don't like and what does clothing mean to them and why is it important or unimportant to them, that does something to a person. I think that I'm the luckiest on the show that I get to have that experience with our heroes.
And focused on kind of building people up and keeping things going with them. You run an Instagram page, Shaded?
I did, yes. And then I turn it into a bigger documentary for the BBC,
Okay, and that's kind of that same theme. That's what you're about.
Yeah, it is. I would like to believe I'm helping people say what they want to say, affording them a voice that they typically wouldn't have, and hopefully leaving a really positive impact. I have two children. I want them to hopefully know me for one thing only, and that is to show my humanity and educate people on my people's humanity.
Yeah, it really is empowering. And I gotta tell you, in doing research and just hearing some of the things that you faced when younger, and then kind of taking on all of these isms, you know, that you've had not even had to, like in some ways you've chosen to take on these challenges.
I mean, look, my family is often, they're often the first ones to say, why do you keep doing this? You don't have to put yourself through it. Cause they see the ish I get online. It got bigger than just me. That's just the way it is. It got bigger than me. And if I stopped, if I quit, and I've thought about this many times in the last few years, if I just quit, they won. All those people who hate seeing somebody like me on TV, they won.
Wow. So tell us, and we're kind of going into all of about you and the different experiences and kind of the cool discussions, but Fab Five Live. Okay, so that's a thing now. It's coming to Philadelphia, February 19th, the Miller Theater, kind of getting everybody together and doing the show live. Like, what's this about?
So we've never done a live show before, the five of us. So I'm really excited about it. This is an interactive version of what you see on the show, but without a makeover. So on the show, we spend a full week with our heroes. And so the makeover feels massive. And it's, as you mentioned earlier, it's not just about the clothes or the hair. It's none of that. It's how did we change your life forever? Mm-hmm. and how will all these things that we've taught you continue on through your life? However, with a live show, we don't want to bastardize the experience by doing an hour version of it. And that would be boring for everybody who's not part of the makeover. So instead, we're showing the audience who we are, the five of us out there. You've never seen us before. And typically on our show, you'll see the five of us together two or three times in an episode, but we are edited down to a minute or two. We want the audience to really understand what our relationship is and how strong we are as a unit. We also got a new cast member last season. And so we want to introduce the new cast member, Jeremiah, and family member to our audience, and for them to really get to know him better. They love him, but we really want to show who he really is. And so we're going to play some incredible games. We're going to do some chats about what it looks like to build an episode. How do we all do our individual parts? But really, it's a night of joy, positivity. We want people to bring their friends and family and to feel like they really felt something that night.
Millions of followers now follow you on social media platforms. Millions and millions are watching the shows. I would imagine as this tour goes around, it's sold out. So did Queer Eye calling you, Tan, feel like it would ever get to this?
No. Gosh, even the first week of the show coming out, I couldn't believe it had gotten to that point. The first person who said hi to me and wanted a selfie was Jon Bon Jovi a day after the show came out. Like, okay. That screws with your head. There's no way of processing that. And so, no, none of that and none of this could ever have been imaginable to me 7.5 years ago.
That would mess with your head. Like, the first shout out you're getting from folks like that now doesn't mess with your head so much because you're getting them all the time.
Well, from the entertainers, no, that is just nice, and that's my colleagues at this point. But from the audience, it still feels beautiful because I don't go out very often. I've created this this sanctuary. I live in Salt Lake City, and I don't go out very often. And so when I do, it feels lovely when people are really sweet about us.
Couple more questions, because it is kind of cool when you talk about what you wanted to do with all of this, and now several years in, you get to look back and kind of see that you have. So looking at it now with all of those isms and all of the challenges and Shaded and all the things that you wanted to do, now I'd imagine it's got to kind of feel pretty cool to know that I got a crew. Like, I got, if you come at me, you're coming at all them.
It feels amazing. I go to this thing called Gold House event in LA, and I'm also going to another one pretty soon. That's not in LA. And going to events like that feels amazing because it's mostly South Asians and Far East Asians. And it's a night to celebrate Asians in Hollywood. And going to things like that really make me feel proud because I just think, oh yeah, collectively we've done something insane the last 7 to 10 years. The landscape of Hollywood has changed so much, and I'm part of that, and that feels really important to me.
Couple more questions. Has it, you talk about the landscape of Hollywood has changed, have those doors opened? Are you seeing more of that? Is it a more comfortable environment?
I mean, to be honest, that it was for a short while, from June 2020 to like a year ago, the big networks were like, we need diversity, we need diversity. We can't keep telling white stories. I'm like, but we're about 50 years late to that, but okay. And being a part of that was wonderful. It does feel like we've gotten too comfortable, and now we're back to the very simple 90s programming, which is we've got to hedge our bets. It must be a white lead. It must be a predominantly white cast. Right. That is infuriating to see. And don't get me wrong, I enjoy a white story just as much as anybody, but there's other stories that can be told. I think that's the reason why we saw a lot of success with great non-white movies or non-straight movies or just marginalized groups getting to tell the story. I think that's why we saw so much success in those. And I think it's sad that we're kind of drifting back to the old days. But I'm hoping we'll get it back. I mean, there's many of us who are constantly reminding networks that there's real business opportunity in representing more than just one demographic.
And that means you still got work to do. So not going back into retirement.
That's right. That is absolutely right.
Continue on with that. One of the things, the way, as I said earlier on, the whole basis of this show is the concept of use your voice for good. So when you hear that phrase, what does that empower you to do? What does that phrase mean to you?
For me, it's whatever circle you are part of. I am a part of a very large public circle, but whatever space you're in, you have an opportunity to use your voice for good if you have good in that voice. You also have space for a lot of bad, but I'm hoping that people will choose to use their voices for positivity, especially at times like this when our country is so divided, the world is so divided. Talk to your friends and family about the things that you think are important and that could actually affect people's lives. We can't keep living in these silos and pretending that the world can continue on like this. It can't. And I think that's the beauty of a show like Queer Eye, is we talk about the things that make people uncomfortable, to try and say it's fine to reach across the aisle. We've got to be able to find commonality and humanity across the aisle.
Queer Eye Fab Five Live, coming to Philadelphia February 19th at the Miller Theater. Some tickets are available. This just gave you a little taste of how much fun you can have sitting there that evening. I
promise it's so much more fun than I was just talking. Wait till you come to the show. It's going to be a hoot.
I feel like you just talking is a hoot. We're learning about you.
It's so much more fun than just telling you something. Believe me, when you see the five of us together,
it's so much better.
It's wild. It's wild.
Guys, thanks so much for listening to the Pulse with Bill Anderson podcast. Today with Tan France from Queer Eye Fab Five. They're on tour, so I encourage any of you, if they're coming to a city near you, to go ahead and check them out. You can tell from the discussion that the energy is there. The desire to initiate change and make the world better is there. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. I absolutely did. Do me a favor, hit the like, subscribe, follow, whatever that button says on your screen. That will get you a notification every week when a new episode of The Pulse comes out. You should check out the Fox Local app. That way you've got all of our shows right there at your fingertips. You can watch them on demand, and you can hit me up and follow me on social media at Bill A. Fox 29. Thank you so much for listening, and I leave you today as I always do, reminding you, whenever you can, use your voice for good and have a good one.